Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And today, not only are we talking about one board game, we're talking about two board games on this very special episode of Board Game Bros. So, Matthew, what games are we talking about today?
We are talking about Century Spice Road and Century Eastern Wonders. Both designed by Emerson Matsuchi and published by Plan B Games in 2017 and 2018, respectively. Spice Road won the Golden Geek Best Card Game of 2017 and was nominated for a bunch of other awards. However, I could not see any nominations on Eastern Wonders' part.
I see.
And I just want to preface this by saying that we didn't really get a chance to play the third in the series, Century A New World.
Mm-hmm.
So keep that in mind.
Yes, and maybe that'll just be a future episode when we play that and discuss it, along with an interesting feature that these games have that we weren't able to play test ourselves.
Yes, we didn't play test it ourselves.
But we did play these two games independently. So for a short description of what Century Spice Road and Century Eastern Wonders are, in Century Spice Roads and Eastern Wonders, players collect and exchange spices into other spices and points. During setup, a number of point scoring cards are set out, which will require a specific combination of spices to collect. After a player has collected a specific number of point cards, the player with the most points wins. And that's a very boiled down version of how to play these games, but it applies to both of these games because they are both about collecting resources, which are spices and herbs in the case of Eastern Wonders, and exchanging them for other spices and then exchanging those for points. So we're going to get into more detail on how to play both of these games. We'll talk about the strategy in both of these games, and then we'll get on to a design discussion. Sorry, I'm tripping over my words here. And we'll differentiate the games when it's important to differentiate, but there's a lot of overlap between these games. So I think we can just preface everything by just saying that these games have a lot in common. Yes. So a lot of the points we make could probably be applicable to both, but let's get into how to play Century Spice Road first, and then we'll talk more about Eastern Wonders and how it's different, and then we'll get into strategy. So
yeah,
Century Spice Road is a pretty simple game when you play it. You'll realize it's a simple game if you ever play it. It's a lot just about collecting cubes of different colors, which represent spices, and exchanging them using cards, and then exchanging them for cards that give you points. So there's two decks. One is a deck of action cards, and the other is a deck of point cards. The action cards will always have either have an input and an output to them, and or the other variety of action card is just acquiring a specific combination of cubes. Let's talk about the cubes. Let me let you talk about the cubes.
So there are four colors of cube: yellow, red, green, and brown. They represent different spices, which I don't have the names of handy.
Yeah. I don't know exactly what they are in the first game, or if they are the same as what they are in the second game, but in Eastern Wonders, they are ginger is the yellow cube, chili is the red cube, tea is the green cube, and cloves are the black cubes, or sorry, brown cubes.
Yeah, so over the course of the game, you will be acquiring new cubes and upgrading cubes, and cards that let you upgrade cubes, such as one of the ones you start with, will go in order from yellow, red, green, brown.
Yes, there's sort of a rarity order where yellow is the most common, followed by red, followed by green, followed by brown. And then, as you mentioned, there's an upgrade mechanic in these games, and the upgrading will upgrade. Whenever you upgrade, you exchange one cube for the cube of the next highest rarity.
Yes.
In Century Spice Road, everybody starts with two cards in their hand, and the rest of the game is sort of a hand-building game. On your turn, you may either play a card, acquire a card, or acquire a point card, or rest. And resting is when you take all the cards from your discard pile and put them back in your hand. After you play a card, it goes to your discard pile. So that's how you get your cards back. So everyone starts with two cards in their hand in Century Spice Roads. One of them acquires two yellow cubes, and the other one upgrades two cubes, which you can use to exchange two cubes for two other cubes of the next highest rarity, or one cube for a cube two rarities up. Everybody also starts with a number of cubes at the beginning of the game. The first player starts with only a couple yellow cubes, and then the further you are in the turn order, the higher rarity or the higher count of cubes you start with. So the goal of the game is to get the most points, and you get the points by acquiring a specific combination of cubes. Everyone can only have 10 cubes at any given point in their supply. So you need to organize those cubes and exchange them properly so that you have the right combination. The point cards will generally ask for you to have some combination of 4 to 6 cubes in your inventory, maybe 7. It might go up to 7. And the point cards can give you anywhere from something like 8 points to 20 points. And that's basically the whole game.
Right.
There's only two other mechanics that you have to keep in mind when you're playing this game. One of them is that whenever you acquire a card, there is a sort of trade row that you acquire cards from the action deck. And you have to pay cubes if you want a card that's further along in the trade row. So from left to right, the first card you can just pick up for free. If you want the second card, you have to place a cube of any color on the first card, and so on and so forth. And whenever you pick up a card, if it had any cubes on it that other players or yourself had placed there earlier to skip ahead of it, you acquire those cubes and put them into your supply.
Yes.
And then the other mechanic to keep in mind is the point cards that come from the point card deck. They operate on a similar trade row. It should be stated that the first trade row for the action cards has 6 spots. The point card trade row only has 5 spots. And the final space on that trade row, or you could call it the first space, I guess, there's a pile of golden coins next to it, and each golden coin represents 3 points. And when you acquire the point card in the final slot, you get 3 points. And if you acquire a card in the second slot, the second to last slot, there's a pile of silver coins next to it. You get 1 silver coin, which is worth 1 bonus point at the end of the game. Sorry, my dog is playing with a toy, and she just kind of nipped my finger. Okay, we're done. We're done. Okay.
So
that mechanic... Oh, I'll let you do it.
When you acquire cards, it slides down the remaining cards after you've acquired one. So as you're obtaining different point cards, it'll slide the unpurchased ones further down towards the coins.
So these two mechanics are just to incentivize people to acquire the less desirable cards, whether they be action cards or point cards. So that's how you play Century Spice Road. You just acquire cubes, exchange them using the cards that you have available to you, and acquire new cards, and then exchange those cubes for points. And then the game ends when a player has acquired 5 point cards.
Yes.
Yes, 5 point cards. So when a player acquires their 5th point card, the turn finishes. So anyone other than, you know, it continues in turn order until it gets to the first player, or the player who started the game. They don't get the last turn. And then everybody counts their points. You add up the points you got from cards, the points you got from bonus coins, and then you also get 1 bonus point for every cube in your supply at the end of the game that's not a yellow cube, and the player with the most points wins. So now let's talk about how that translates to Eastern Wonders, because Eastern Wonders took this game system and then added a board component.
Yes.
And utilizes that board component in a couple different ways. So I'll let you take that description.
So in Eastern Wonders, players play as marketers on a ship traveling between different markets in sort of a port city, gathering and exchanging spices once again, and selling those off at greater sort of seaports. The board is made up of, I believe, 24 tiles total. Little hex tiles. There are 4 port tiles, and there are the rest of them are markets.
Yeah, 20 markets and 4 port tiles.
Yes. At the start of the game, players place their boats on this board, which represents their, you know, player token. And on a player's turn, they can move 1 space to an adjacent hexagon tile and do a number of actions, such as building an outpost, which is a little sort of building token showing that you have an outpost on that market. If you build an outpost on a market, you can then use its tile to exchange spices. Much like the cards in Spice Road, you can exchange a certain set amount of spices of a certain color to get others in return, sort of a input and output, like you said.
Actually, I do want to kind of specify what those inputs and outputs yes. look like, because it's similar for both games, where you're either exchanging a number of lesser value resources to get a smaller number of higher value resources. So, for example, you might exchange 5 yellow cubes to get 2 brown cubes, or a brown and a green cube. These sorts of actions show up in both games. And then the other type of action is to exchange high value resources in a small amount to a large quantity of lower value resources. So, for example, there might be an action that lets you exchange 1 brown cube for a green cube, a red cube, and 2 yellow cubes.
Yeah. So it messes around with the quantities and types of cubes you have in yes. very specific ways. So when you move your boat, you normally move one space for free. You can move additional spaces by placing a cube of your choice on each space you pass up after the first. And then also, if you end your turn on a space where another player's boat is, you have to pay them 1 cube. So if you don't want to interact with a market on the space you're on, you can harvest, which just gets you 2 yellow cubes for free.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, your goal is to reach one of the 4 ports, which has a sort of scoring point token. The point tokens, much like the point cards from Spice Road, have a requirement in cubes of about 4 to 7 or 6.
I think 6 is the maximum in this game.
About 4 to 6. And you spend the cubes while you're on that space to acquire the point token. And the game ends when a player has achieved, I believe, their 4th point token.
Yes.
There is an additional aspect where after the first 4 or so ports have been scored, then there is a closed port that rotates around the board, which means that there's only 3 spots that can have a point token. Additionally, there is sort of a player tableau aspect. So mm-hmm. there is still the inventory of 10 cubes, but whenever you build an outpost, depending on what space you bought or you built it on, you remove the outpost from a certain part of your board, your player tableau. And then when you fill out an entire column of these, then...
Or rather, empty an entire column.
Right, sorry. When you empty an entire column of spaces that had outposts, you gain a bonus tile. And these range from having bonus points, which I believe starts at 6, and then 5, then 4, then 3.
Mm-hmm.
There is extra inventory space, adding 3 inventory spaces at a time. There is the ability to upgrade a cube whenever you build an outpost. There is the ability to move an extra space every turn for free without having to pay any sort of cubes.
There's one other, and that's the... what does that do?
It gives it lets you a free red cube whenever you harvest.
Oh, right, that one.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the upgrade and the free red cube also give a small amount of bonus points at the end of the game.
Right. They both each give a single bonus point for each of those upgrades you acquired.
Additionally, if you empty out further down the row for each set of outposts, mm-hmm. then you'll get extra bonus points as well.
Right. And just to explain why, like when you take from each row, essentially the markets on the board in this game have a suit to them. There's 4 suits. They correspond with the 4 types of spice that you're trading, or the 4 colors of cube. There's a yellow suit, a red suit, a green suit, and a brown suit. And you have 4 rows of these outposts on your tableau for each of these suits. So when you place 1 outpost on 1 market of each suit, so one outpost on a yellow market, 1 outpost on a red, 1 on a green, 1 on a brown, that's when you clear a column and you get a bonus tile. And as you place more outposts of the same suit, you unlock bonus points for the end of the game. And you unlock higher and higher bonus points the more outposts you place from each given row.
Yeah.
So you can see now that the second game bears a lot of similarities to the first game. You're performing a lot of the same actions, or rather, you're performing a lot of the same actions. You're just adding this extra dimensional element to the game with the board, where rather than picking up cards and playing them down, you have to move around this board to get to the actions. Rather than spending points to get the better cards further in the trade row, or sorry, not points, but cubes, you're spending cubes instead to move your boat around. There's also one element where if you place an outpost on a market that already has outposts on it, you have to pay a cube per outpost that's already in the market.
Yeah, the player interaction works a bit differently.
Yes. Rather it being entirely first come, first serve, there's now a cost to not being the first person to a place.
Mm-hmm.
The points are still first come, first serve. And like you said, it takes 4 point cards in this game. They're tokens to end the game. It ends in a similar way where everyone who hasn't yet had a turn that round gets their turn. And then the points in this game come in similar amounts. I think they range from 8 to 20 points per card.
Yeah, on the point tokens.
On the point tokens. Okay, so I think that is basically it for how to play these games. So shall we get into the strategy discussion?
I do want to bring up the fact that these games have a rule set for combining the two.
Yes.
And then when you add a new world, it has rule sets for combining all three. We did not get a good chance to do this, you know, mm-hmm. partially because of the sort of current, you know, situations. I wanted to go over just really briefly what the differences in rules are like.
Sure.
So if you combine Eastern Wonders and Spice Road, you have both the boat and the market board, as well as the cards from Spice Road. You still play the cards from Spice Road and use their effects like normal, but also if you want to move the boat, you have to discard cards from your hand equal to the amount of spaces you want to move. You do not get a free move.
So you don't get a free move.
Mm-hmm.
And does this also take the place of the cube movement rule in the first game or game? Okay.
Again, we didn't play this, so I might get a few things wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then you continue through the board kind of like beforehand. You still use ports to get point cards, but you can also use the and acquire the Spice Road cards for actions. Markets are sort of a separate action you can take instead of playing cards as well.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of a hybrid of the two.
Okay. All right, so strategy.
Yes.
So the first strategy point that I have to give applies to both games, which is just to look at the scoring tiles first and identify which tile you want to go for, which card you want to go for in the case of the first game, and figure out which combination of cubes you need for that card, and then get to that combination of cubes in the fewest number of turns possible, because every turn is spent performing a single action. So you want to spend the fewest number of turns getting to that combination of cubes so that you can get that point value first. And in addition to that, it's helpful to have a backup strategy just in case multiple people go for the same strategy and another player other than you ends up getting to it first, ends up getting to the combination first. Maybe they just happen to luck into a better card, or they started at a better part of the board in the case of the second game. And so they get the combination of cubes one turn earlier or a couple turns earlier. Have a backup strategy for what you can do with your cube so you didn't waste all those turns.
Yeah. Additionally, a good example of this is to try to find cards that overlap in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Like when we played Spice Road, there was a card that had a cost of 4 brown and 2 green and one that had a cost of 4 green and 2 brown. So I kind of built my engine to support those two colors. Because I knew that I could get one of those, at least.
That's also another way of thinking of it. You could just kind of consider what type of engine the other players are building and build an engine that acquires different colors in different combinations than they do. So if, like, in that game, if I were to notice, like, oh, Matthew's cards convert things into green and brown really often. I'm going to go for cards that give me a lot of red and yellow, because we're not going to be competing over those resources then.
Yeah. There was a time where I saw that you were really close to one specific card in terms of, like, you needed two turns to get it. And mm-hmm. so I pivoted off what I was doing to try and get something else later.
Yeah. If you don't have a backup plan from the beginning of your strategy, like, definitely try and identify when somebody else is much closer to something than you are, so that you can pivot as soon as possible. If you pivot a turn earlier, it could make a big difference.
Yeah.
Another point with scoring is, once you do have the combination of cubes that you need to score a card or a tile in the second game, you don't have to do it immediately if other players aren't about to take it for themselves. So, you know, if I get that 4 green and 2 brown cubes in my supply and nobody else has 4 green and 2 brown yet, I don't have to get that card on my next turn necessarily. I can wait a couple turns. I can let other people get closer and closer to it. But as soon as one player finally assembles the combination on their turn, they have to wait till their next turn to turn it in, or to exchange it for the point card. And that's when I can get the point card. Sometimes this could trick somebody who maybe they aren't paying attention into wasting some turns to collect those cubes just for you to take the card from them. Other times it's just like you can use your turns to save up for the next card. And then when you have nothing better to do, go back for that card.
You can also stall, because it could be that if you were to buy that card now, then the next card on top of the deck would be easier for another player to get. A big thing about this game is that because the game ends when a player gets points, it means that there will be a player who has more point cards than the others, most likely, unless people happen to time their point acquisition at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
This means that as long as you're kind of keeping relatively even in terms of value, having the point card tempo advantage is pretty important.
True.
Because, like, if you have 2 cards and everybody else has 1, you can play a little looser and try to go for some cheaper cards to end the game quicker. And that's, you know, also a reward for planning out your engine and playing efficiently. But also, if nobody else is going to buy a card soon, you can wait, because the next card could be quicker for them to buy, and then you'll have less of a point card tempo.
Mm-hmm. In addition, for the first game, at least, the cards that are further along in the trade row for the point card trade row give you bonus points, either 1 or 3, depending on how far along they are. So if you have the resources saved up for a card that isn't earning bonus points, you could just sit on it and wait for other people to acquire the cards in the bonus point slots, and then your card will slide down and eventually be worth bonus points.
Yeah. I have to assume there's some sort of, maybe not an exact metric, but there's probably a rule of thumb somewhere for how many turns a point is worth. Because I was thinking about this, like, so when we played, I mainly went for brown and green cubes, but those take a lot longer to reach because that's sort of how the game is balanced. The higher rarities take longer to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to wonder if it's better to get cards that require fewer brown tokens, especially, because those are the hardest to get and take the most turns. Because, like, if you're taking 11 turns to get every point card you get, that's 55 turns. But if you were to save 2 turns, then that would be, 45 turns? And so
I would
just cut off 10 turns by not going for a certain color.
I think it's definitely valuable to consider how many turns it'll take you to get a card and see if there's cards that you can get in fewer turns, and consider how many turns per point you're getting in that situation. So I think on a case-by-case basis, you could do an evaluation like this and come to a conclusion. I think if you tried to do it for the whole game, it would be very difficult.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, there's so many different cards that exchange so many different combinations of resources into other combinations of resources. And then you'd also have to take into account that earlier in the game, it takes more turns to acquire things because you have to rest more often.
Right.
But later in the game, you don't have to rest. So that's an extra turn in the early games where you're doing nothing, but it's still a turn that you have to take in order to acquire a card.
Right.
And you have to take that fewer and fewer times as the game goes on.
Yeah. Kind of piggybacking off of that, whenever you have the opportunity to either harvest or to take a card from the trade row that has two or more cubes on it, you should take the card from the trade row, because at most you're not losing any cubes by doing so. This is assuming you have nothing better to do.
Mm-hmm.
And at best, that card that you draft could be better in the future, because there's no like maximum hand size. There's no penalty to having a lot of cards.
Right. When you say harvest, the first game didn't have a generic action for acquiring two yellow cubes.
I guess, but I mean more like playing the card that gives you two yellow cubes.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody has that card that gives you two yellow cubes at the start of the game. And you'll keep that card for the whole game, and sometimes you'll end up with it in your hand after you've rest a couple times, and you might consider playing it because you need two yellow cubes, but the card in the trade row, there's maybe a card in the trade row that has two cubes on it, two yellow cubes most likely, because people have been skipping over it. So yeah, like you're saying, it's more valuable to take that card, A, because in the future you might not need to rest. And also, it could be extremely valuable for reaching a specific combination of cubes for a card. It could save you a turn then. And yeah, it's just, and like you said, there's no maximum hand size. So there's no punishment for having dead cards in your hand.
Yeah.
I guess the only punishment is purely like a brain, like, capacity punishment, where you do have that card in your hand, and maybe it's information overload for some players. I'm adding that to my D&D campaign.
Very good.
Nobody take it. Yeah. No, wait, you can take it. It's D&D. It's not like... Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to sell D&D at the moment. Okay. So.
So.
Let's talk more about strategy specific to the second game, to Eastern Wonders. So first of all, a strategy that I did not identify when we started playing the first time we played this game was that it's very important to get a lot of... outposts out on the map really quickly, like getting those four outpost bonus tiles that let you move further or give you bonus cubes whenever you harvest is really valuable, and also just playing your tiles for free on the board, because you're not having to place outposts where other people have outposts and having to pay extra for that. Is very valuable, and it gives you a bunch of bonus points at the end of the game too if you put out a bunch of outposts, because you're clearing rows out.
Yeah.
So, yes, I highly, highly recommend first thing you do in this game is, I mean, identify which spaces are going to be valuable, but then just put a bunch of outposts out there. My mistake was I identified two spaces that worked really well, which is another strategy point, is to identify the spaces that work really well together. You know, that like exchange cubes back and forth so that you're ending up with a lot of resources really quickly without having to move too far. But I spent my first turns putting the outposts and exchanging, and then my next two or three turns just going between the two of them and exchanging back and forth and back and forth till I had a lot of cubes that I could exchange for points. It was worth a lot of points at the beginning of the game, but after all of that, everywhere I went, there was already outposts, so I had to pay a lot of cubes to put my own outposts out there, and by the end of the game, I had placed the fewest outposts on the board, so I did not get a lot of bonus points from those.
Yeah. I think as far as the bonus tiles go, I do recommend getting the first 2-point tiles, especially the 6 and 5, just because those are pretty strong, and they have, like, most point tokens on the ports give you between 8 and 15 or so points, right?
Mm-hmm.
20?
20 is the maximum. I think on average they give you around 15.
Yeah.
But yeah, 8 is the minimum.
So you're getting about a third of a token, a third of a port token for zero cost. You're giving up the ability to move a bit faster or get some red cubes. I think those are definitely good, but it feels to me more like it's better to take that that chance at not needing as high scoring of a point token in the end of the game. You know, you could try to end the game sooner by getting something cheaper, and then you'll still be up, something like that.
Yeah, I would say it depends on the game. I think you want to get it. You at least want to get it before it's down to the 4-point token, because like after you place your next four outposts, you've already earned 4 bonus points. So you can sort of think that 4 outposts is worth at least 4 points. So any fewer than 4 is kind of like a waste of what the game thinks your outposts are worth when you clear columns. And any more than 4 is more than what the game thinks it's worth. But if it's not down to that point and you don't see anybody else getting close to it anytime soon, I think getting the extra value of like moving your ship an extra space every turn for free, or getting an extra red cube with every harvest, I think early on those are pretty valuable.
Sure, yeah.
I would say it just depends on how contested the bonus point tiles are.
Yeah.
You know, if someone's taken the 6, you should probably take the 5 before it gets down to the 4.
Mm-hmm.
If nobody has, then consider going for the extra move or the extra cube.
Yeah.
The extra space tile, I don't think that one's ever going to be worth it, in my opinion.
Yeah, the extra inventory space.
It's like, the way I see the extra inventory space is it's probably only valuable for moving long distances across the board, in which case you could have just taken the bonus move tile for your bonus that gives you an extra move every turn, so which
there's
sort of does a similar thing.
There's two important notes here. One is that in Eastern Wonders, there's no like cooldown on markets. So the reason identifying two spaces that work well together works is because you don't have to like rest or anything. As long as you can move between two spaces, you can use them one after another. Additionally, something we forgot to mention, is that when you use a market, you can use it any number of times on that turn, as long as you have the cubes to actually pay for it.
Right. So for example, there's a space that exchanges a red and a yellow cube for one brown cube. But if you have 3 red and 3 yellow cubes, you can exchange all of them for 3 brown cubes.
Yeah.
In a single turn.
Yeah. So I think the intention is if you're getting like 3 or 4 cubes out of a market, having the inventory space would let you hold them all.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more of an insurance for after you score points, though, because since a lot of point tokens will take sort of most of your inventory space to buy, it means that you'll be left with a few less afterwards. But getting the token or getting the tile that lets you get free red cubes when you harvest, and getting the one that gives you free movement helps minimize the impact of that. Because you don't need as many cubes to pay for movement, and you'll be able to get more cubes quicker and then turn those into other things at markets quicker with the red cube tile.
I would give one more plus to the free movement upgrade tile in this game, just because when you place a cube down on a space to skip over it, then that's a cube that one of your opponents could pick up by ending up on that space. Of course, you could just plan your routes, because since it's a hex grid, there's a number of ways to get like across the board, a number of paths you can take. So there's no like in most cases, you have a decision of like the route you take. And so you can place cubes on spaces that your opponents are less likely to want to go on. But every cube you place down could be, you know, a net for your opponents. So it's not like you're losing one cube. It's like you're losing 2, or you're losing 1 cube and your opponents are gaining 1 cube.
Yeah.
Versus free movement is free movement. You keep your cubes, your opponents get nothing.
So one thing I did when we played was there was a period where I was just harvesting. So I went to the space that Jeffrey was going to go to as part of his 2 space combo and just kind of camped there.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you move into another player's space and end there, you have to pay them a cube. So if you're going to stay in one spot and harvest, you can interrupt those like combos that other players have. Or if you just kind of have a read that they're going to go somewhere, like maybe they have a very specific amount of cubes in their inventory to pay for a cost, you can always try to camp them out like that.
Yes.
It doesn't really impact you if you're just harvesting, because you can do that anywhere, as long as you don't have to spend any extra resources to move there.
I just want to say that in this game, it's public knowledge what, like, all of the different exchange options are. So you can figure out exactly how many turns it'll take for an opponent to acquire a certain combination of cubes. And therefore, you can predict which tiles are contested and whether you or they will get there sooner. And that's not really possible in the first game, just because all of the cards exchange in such different and unique ways that and it's so hard to keep track of what all of the cards do and like which cards your opponents have and what they do specifically. So it's really difficult in the first game to figure out exactly how many turns your opponents are away from collecting a specific combination of cubes. So use that to your advantage in this game. In this game being the second game.
Yeah.
Eastern Wonders. Okay. Do you have any more strategy points to make?
No.
Okay. I don't believe... Oh, yeah. Definitely shoot for the higher point value cards, since there's a limit to how many there's a limit to how many cards you can have to end the game. Shoot for the higher point values, unless you have some sort of magical engine that can rapidly acquire low-value cards.
Yeah.
And those low-value cards are continuing to appear. You know, in both games, you're drawing from a deck or a pile of tiles to determine what the point cards are and what cubes they need. So it's going to be random whether there's going to be some low value cards for you to go for to speed the game up, or if it's all going to be high value. I think it's better to try and shoot for the higher value ones most of the time. Okay, so let's talk about... Well, actually, first of all, since we talked about strategy, now it's time for our little mid-episode plug break where we do some plugs. And on the other side of that, we'll talk about design.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay, time for some plugs. So you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at BG Bros Cast and hit us up there with suggestions for games and topics you'd like to hear us cover, and also just interact with us in general. If you have a nice comment to say about the podcast, we appreciate everything that gets every mention we get, every like and retweet. We love it all and greatly appreciate it. You can go to bgbcast.com. That's our website where we have all of our episodes posted and cataloged. You can use our search bar there to find specific episodes if there's something you're looking for our thoughts on there. We also have a little email form that you could fill out there if you want to hit us up with suggestions or any other sort of official communication with us. You can find a link to our TeePublic store on our website, which is teepublic.com/users/bgbcast, where we have merch with our cool logo on it. And that's about it for BG Bros plugs, so let's hear it for Matt plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/twak. I stream on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday from about 1 p.m. Central Time to 3 or 4 p.m. Central Time. I stream speedruns, competitive games, roguelikes, roguelites, what have you. On Fridays, I have been doing 47 Fridays, where I play Hitman 3. Or the Hitman World of Assassination trilogy, and people watching can interact and impose different challenges on me. So check that out. Always a great time. There's also a link to a Discord server through there that you can use to interact with us and other fans of our work. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at MattCraigGaming, where I tweet my hot takes, my tepid takes, my cool takes. And keep an eye out there, because I have a interesting announcement on that coming up pretty soon. And you can also listen to my other podcast, NetSurfer Pro, a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web, where me and my friend Galen talk about interesting media, such as movies, music, TV shows, video games, internet things. We have a segment where we talk about internet memes. So if you get really confused about what the kids are going on these days with, like, Sus and Among Us, we've got you covered.
All right.
Technically, Board Game Bros did have you covered as well, but not quite the same.
Yes. All right. And if you would like, you can also follow me on Twitter at Jeff Craig Designs. Okay. So let's talk now about design of these games.
Yes.
So the first thing I want to start off with is that, in my opinion, the level up mechanic in the first game really goes a long way when it comes to like understanding the depth of the flavor and mechanics in this game, especially
the flavor of the spices,
the depth of the flavor. Yeah. I mean, spices add depth of flavor to a dish, and they add depth of flavor to the flavor and the mechanics in this game.
Wow, because you explain the rules and you explain the jokes.
If the upgrade card in the first game didn't exist, it would just be a game about exchanging cubes, and the value of the cubes would not be very obvious. Like, I guess it would be obvious that the yellow cubes are the most common just because you start with a bunch of them and you start with a card that gives you them, and they appear in the most quantity on a lot of cards. But I think the values of the other spices in the first game would be a lot less easy, a lot harder to suss out, to figure out like which one is the most rare and why. Yeah. And so without having an understanding of like the rarity of the cubes, and you know, like why brown cubes are so sought after, you know, if that didn't come through in the game without like that upgrade card, then I feel like it would just be a game about exchanging cubes, and there wouldn't be a lot of interest, in my opinion, in like the mechanics or the flavor of the game.
Yeah, so I think if you played the game long enough, you'd probably realize like, oh, the cards with the most brown cubes are the ones that are the most points, or the cards that exchange cubes for brown cubes are the ones that give you the fewest returns. But yeah, it wouldn't be as obvious, and I think having that upgrade mechanic be explained in the rulebook and being interactable from turn one, like you said, it helps you kind of intuit things like how long it'll take to get a card. Like, you don't need to necessarily know the exact turn count, but you could be like, this card that needs 4 brown cubes and 2 green cubes is going to take quite a while.
Mm-hmm. Especially because at the beginning, your only tools are get yellow cubes and upgrade yellow cubes. So when you see like the card that takes 2 brown cubes and 2 green cubes, that's like, oh my gosh, I gotta upgrade my 2 yellow cubes into 2 red cubes, then upgrade them into green cubes, then acquire 2 new yellow cubes, then upgrade them into red cubes, and upgrade them into green cubes, and upgrade them into brown cubes. That's so many turns I have to take just to get that one card. And then you eventually acquire cards that shorten that turn amount, but from the beginning you just realize like, oh my gosh, how many turns does it take to get brown cubes? It takes forever.
Yeah.
If that didn't exist, it would just feel like a game about exchanging cubes. It does already kind of just feel like a game about exchanging cubes. Like, the only action you do in this game is either exchange cubes or get points. Exchange cubes for points. Exchange cubes for cubes or cubes for points.
Yeah, both games or are pretty abstract, but Spice Road even more so.
Mm-hmm.
The spices are represented visually on the cards, but in the form of like bags of spices. There's not a clear indication of what they actually are in the artwork, other than just bags of spices. And I do want to say that I don't know if this is something you or other people do, but I tend to give games the benefit of the doubt and assume they're well-designed, in the sense that if I see something worth a lot of points, I tend to assume it will be harder to get.
Yeah.
I don't know if that is a good mindset to go into playing new games with, but I can at least understand, like, you know, maybe it doesn't need to outright say, like, this is harder to get in the rule book, but it does, yeah, I mean, it does say that brown cubes are harder to get, but, like, it does manage to kind of keep a consistent amount of, like, cube to point value ratio. It's not necessarily a hard fast ratio, but it is there.
Certain things in this game are definitely not hard and fast. Like, there's cards that are worth one card, but they'll be more valuable cube wise than another card in this game. Like, for example, you start with a card that gives you 2 yellow cubes when you play it. There's cards in the deck that give you 3 yellow cubes when you play it. There's a card that gives you 4 yellow cubes when you play it. There's a card that gives you 5 yellow cubes when you play it. I think that exists. You know, maybe. And I didn't go through the deck, so I don't know if the 3 yellow cube card, there's more copies of that than the 4 yellow cube card. My gut instinct is to say there isn't. There's just one copy of each. So there's cards that are strictly better than other cards, which makes me realize that, like, there's no hard math. Like, this cube is worth this many of another cube. You know, there's one card that'll exchange 4 yellow cubes into 2 brown cubes, and there's a card that exchanges 4 yellow cubes into a brown cube and a green cube. You know, rarity-wise, these are not identical. The brown cubes are worth more. Now, when it comes to the combinations of cubes you need to score the point cards, a green and a brown cube may be more valuable than 2 brown cubes, because you need a green and a brown cube to get the 20-point card, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's all a little vague in this game. In some ways, that's kind of a good thing, just because, like, this is a function that's designed into Magic the Gathering, where they intentionally design cards that are worse than other cards, just because that's part of learning the game, is being able to recognize that and understand when a card is better than another card and why a card is better than another card, so that when you're selecting your cards, whether it's drafting or building your deck, you're making very informed decisions. And so that mechanic exists sort of in this game, or that feature of the game exists here, where there's certain cards that are actually slightly better than other cards.
So,
and there is a skill to identifying that.
Yeah. So this was a really complicated thing for me to kind of think about, I guess.
Okay.
The, like, inner sort of balance-heavy game designer side of me really dislikes this. There were some times playing the game where, like, I would get a card that gives me 2 cubes of a certain color, and then one would show up a few turns later that's, like, strictly better, and I'd be upset about it. I think it exists to give reason to buy further cards and to differentiate strategies.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, somebody getting a better exchange rate on their cards might push them towards a slightly different engine. And additionally, if there's 2 cards that have different exchange rates, one better than the other, their position in the trade row might be important.
Right.
I say it's because it could be that the better one is earlier, and then you might as well just take it anyways. I think the ideal scenario is it appearing after the bad one, so you have to make a choice between paying cubes and, you know, quality later.
I mean, for the most part, it will come after, just because unless it shows up in the first deal of the trade row, the new cards are always placed at the very end. So the best cards will always appear in the spot where you'll have to pay the most cubes to acquire them. But, you know, if you're playing with other players that don't understand the values of these cubes and they just let it slide on up to the spot where it costs nothing to acquire, then, I mean, that's just a situation where it pays to be better at the game, or to understand the game better than your opponents.
It was hard to tell.
Which is something some people might think is a good thing.
I think in the end, the sheer difference between cards eventually makes itself up, because it's unlikely that one player has all of the best returns.
Yeah.
It's kind of spread evenly. I will say this is very thematic. Century, like I said, is pretty abstract, so it's hard to really get the theme while playing. But the theme of Spice Roads is like a bazaar full of people rapidly trading goods.
Yeah.
And the idea of, like, bartering for a better deal, or being able to get a better deal at one merchant from another, something like that, is a bit more thematic for what they're going for. Is this, like, specific period in time? There's no hard costs of things, no hard rewards, because there isn't really that type of, you know, like, set in stone exchange rate when there's a lot of, like, haggling and bartering around.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything else to say about Spice Road specifically?
Not specifically Spice Roads, but I do have a more sweeping design term. But we can talk about Eastern Wonders first.
Right, okay. Yeah. So, Eastern Wonders, there's 2 points I want to make about it. The first is that the added dimension in strategy and also just physical dimension of the game, I think is very welcome. This is basically like an evolution of the first game. I don't really see it as like a new game in and of itself. You know, it just takes the elements of the first game and then adds these two or three new mechanics. And I think the game turns out better for it.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's a caveat to that. The second point that I want to make is that there is a way to upgrade cubes in the game, but it is not available from the beginning of the game, and it's not really at the forefront of your mind when you start a game of Eastern Wonders. And because of that, the intrinsic value of these cubes becomes a little bit lost in the second game.
Yeah.
And therefore, the points that I made with the first game, where because like you have that upgrade card and that makes you understand something about the game, and that like adds a whole lot of depth to your view of the game, you know, that depth is lost in the second game a little bit because there's no real upgrade function.
Yeah, I mean, there is. And so if you were to read the rule book, you would get that. But it's definitely not visible during early gameplay. I think it doesn't help that the like suits on the market tiles represent the cubes, or they match the colors of the cubes. But since the market tiles are all pretty much the same in terms of value, and they have the same quantity of each color, it kind of makes them look like equals, more like just different suits of cubes, since that's kind of how the suits of tiles are presented.
Yeah, it's not like there's fewer brown suited tiles than there are yellow suited tiles.
Yeah, and I couldn't tell if the brown markets were any better than the yellow.
I think the suit of the market just indicates the primary color of cube you get when you exchange resources there. So when you exchange cubes at a brown market, you're most likely going to end up with brown cubes in some combination or amount. Although that's in the red markets, you know, you'll get red cubes, and in the yellow markets, you'll get yellow cubes, but you'll also get cubes of other colors most of the time, because just exchanging into just yellow cubes is not often worth your resources.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, though. I think Eastern Wonders is a game that you're meant to play after Spice Road. In a lot of ways, it feels like a lot of the mechanics are made to compare to Spice Road.
Yeah.
In this case, like, if you played Spice Road like we did, then you know how the sort of value of each cube works and how those will appear on the scoring tiles. But if you haven't, then I could see how it could be a little harder to understand that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the way player interaction works in Eastern Wonders. I think in Spice Road, you could, like, hate draft people, or you could get cards before them, but it ultimately felt like the play interaction was just getting things before other players.
Yeah, honestly, playing Spice Road, it felt a little solitaire at times.
Yeah, and I'm not one to use solitaire as an insult against a multiplayer board game. I like Dominion, early Dominion, but I think Eastern Wonders, having played it in like the same session, really stuck out to me more in the long run. Like when I after the night was done, I was more interested in replaying Eastern Wonders than I was Spice Road. And part of that was because, like, if there was a combo like Jeffrey saw first, I was able to replicate it or interrupt it or make him make a decision on what to do. The difference in movement felt more like I could plan ahead. So that, like, if somebody had a similar goal to me, I could try to race them by getting a few more extra cubes beforehand. The whole outpost system meant there was different strategies early game.
Ooh, I really liked one aspect of the setup of the second game, where in the first game, it was, like, predetermined what combination of cubes everyone got at the beginning of the game based on their turn order, with their spot in the turn order. In the second game, you make four different piles of cubes that sort of match the same cubes that players would get in the first game. There's like a pile of four yellow, there's a pile of two yellow, one red, a pile of two red, and a pile of one yellow, one green. But in reverse turn order, you get to choose which pile you take.
Yeah.
Which I really enjoyed. And that added this extra little bit of strategy that you get to take right at the beginning of the game, which is like, not only do I get to choose where my boat starts, but I have to choose what combination of cubes I start with, and I want to choose the combination of cubes that gets the engine chugging faster. Like, if I want my boat to start on the space that converts two yellow cubes into two red cubes, if I start with the four yellow cubes, I immediately have four red cubes.
Right. I think sort of the thing about this is that a lot of the parts that make Eastern Wonders different and in my eyes better are things that don't exist in Spice Road, just because Eastern Wonders has more mechanics. Yeah. I don't even mean, like, I literally mean there's more verbs you use. A lot of game designers I've heard recently talk about verbiage and verbs, like what actions are the player taking. Mm-hmm. In Spice Road, it's get cards and get cubes and play cards. Eastern Wonders has get cubes, exchange cubes, build outposts, get tiles. There's just more moving parts.
Mm-hmm. Literally.
Yeah. But so I guess that would bring me to my final main point, sort of the relation between these games.
Sure.
So last episode we talked about Palace of Mad King Ludwig, and I talked a bit about how it's kind of weird and awkward to make a series of board games. Century is a trilogy of board games, and it tackles this problem. Just to refresh, the thing is that, like, board games are generally expected to be replayable. And most things that have sequels, most media that have sequels or have a series, are installments that are very similar but build off it in some way to maybe not obsolete the previous one, but they're expected to work with the previous one.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you were to watch a TV show that has like a continuous storyline, you could rewatch it from the start. But the later episodes build off the previous ones to the point where you wouldn't rewatch the first episode over and over. Unless you wanted to watch it over and over, I guess. But maybe that's not the best way to put it. But basically the point I'm saying is that because board games are meant to be played repeatedly a lot, people generally expect each board game they buy to be replayable and to not obsolete the previous ones. Most series of board games come in the form of expansions, which just build onto the previous ones, kind of like a storyline in a TV show.
Therefore not obsoleting the first one?
Yes, just expanding it.
Sure.
But if you wanted to make a completely separate game, there's sort of a different question there. Like, people don't want to have their old game obsoleted. How do you build off of that while still making it new? Century kind of does this in a weird way by making it both a standalone and an expansion. The games have, like, rule sets for combining them. They, mm-hmm. in all purposes, they exist as both standalone games with their own rule sets that are unique, and then the fusion sort of rule set that is different from the standalone version. So in this way, it is a new game you could replay, but also they can combine together, which further justifies having different games.
Right. Your first game is no longer obsolete because you can combine it with your new game to make an even newer game.
Or you could play it as its own.
Sure.
So the reason this works is because the cubes are very modular. They're very abstract, but that means they can be repurposed in the different games.
Mm-hmm.
Both games have pretty much the same resource hierarchy and resource sort of cost effect ratio. I mean, we talked about how it's not represented quite well in Eastern Wonders by itself, but the similarities not only exist to make playing a later game easier when you know the other one, but they exist because that way it balances the combination of the games.
Sure.
Like, the exchange rates are the same between the cards and the markets, so it doesn't make a huge change in how you approach them or evaluate them if you combine the games or keep them separate. It does mean that the games' differences are a bit more highlighted since their, like, core resource management is very similar. And I think that's sort of why Eastern Wonders feels like an upgraded version of Spice Road already, is that since Spice Road didn't have a lot going on as far as, like, you know, a variety of mechanics, Eastern Wonders kind of implements the mechanic Spice Roads has, but then adds on to it. Like, the markets are very similar to the cards in Spice Road. And so when Eastern Wonders has the markets that are like the cards, a little different, but mostly the same, but then it also adds, like, outposts, it kind of already feels like it's obsoleting the previous game. Like, there's not much that is actually... Century Spice Road, it was made first. I don't know if these games were made in, like, at the same time as far as design phase, but it feels like Century Spice Road was designed first because it doesn't have a lot that stands out for itself upon playing Eastern Wonders. There's probably an easier way to state that.
I have a couple thoughts with this discussion.
Yeah.
In the vein of this discussion. And I guess the first one is that, oh gosh, I had a good one that was building off of something you said, but now I can't remember it, but I'm going to go to the second one. That's okay. So the cubes are very modular, and that's true. And that makes it very easy for these games to utilize them and utilize the same pieces or the same objects or what am I meaning? Like, you can use the cards and the tiles. They do the same thing, so it's easy to combine them because they use the same pieces in the same way. This does not make me excited to combine these games. Like, I think if someone had told me Century Eastern Wonders and Century Spice Road, before I knew what they did... Oh, now I remember the second point. Okay. Anyways, before I knew what the games were about, if you had said, like, oh, they're two standalone games, but you can combine them into a third game, I'd be like, that's a really cool idea. I would really like to check that out. So we played both games, and now I'm like, they're kind of the same game. So I'm not super interested to combine the cards that exchange cubes for cubes with the tiles that exchange cubes for cubes to make just two options for exchanging cubes for cubes. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like imagine a game like Scythe, and you broke its parts down into individual games. So there was a game about building mechs that provide upgrades, and there was a game about scouring the land for resources and converting them into whatever, workers and structures. You know, those, if you can split those mechanics like that, then that becomes two different games that are very different from one another, and then they would combine into Scythe. I think that would be a really cool thing to play. I would love to play something like that. A game, two games with very different mechanics that combine into a third game that makes you make very interesting choices. In this game, with Century, Eastern Wonders, and Spice Road, it doesn't feel like the games are very different, as we've described. And combining them, I don't see how I would make unique, interesting choices. The game would not feel unique to the two games that are creating it. So that's one point. The second point is... we haven't played the third game in this series, in this trilogy, which is, what is it called? A New World?
Yeah.
Century, A New World.
It's about America.
And so I think maybe some of the criticisms we're levying or the comments we're making here about how, you know, Eastern Wonders kind of outdoes the first game, and it just seems like an improvement over the first game, and it makes it sort of like the first game becomes a little more obsolete and less interesting to replay. A New World could be sort of like a parallel design to Eastern Wonders rather than an upgrade the way that Spice Road is into Eastern Wonders. I'm interested to know what the evolution is between Eastern Wonders and A New World, because if they are different enough, then that would make me interested in combining them. And also it would sort of forgive the first game for being so simple. Because the first game was just sort of like a building block in this case, into the more complicated versions of the game.
Yeah.
So we're probably going to have to readjust our opinions on the comparisons of the games and how they combine after we've played the third game. So I guess be on the lookout for that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, as it stands, just with these two games in mind, it does not feel that interesting to combine them. It does not seem like it would be that interesting. Again, we didn't play it, so take all these comments again with another grain of salt when we're talking about combining them.
Salt is sort of a spice.
It's a mineral, actually.
Oh,
okay. I don't really know what the definition of spice is, but my gut is telling me that salt is not technically a spice. If only we had Rob Davio here to tell us the answer. So yeah, take it all with a grain of salt, but I think maybe it does speak to at least something that I'm not interested in combining these games.
Yeah.
The last point that I have to make about this is that while the execution that Century Spice Roads and Century Eastern Wonders ended on wasn't necessarily a hit, for in my opinion, I think that the concept is really cool. Like I mentioned, like if somebody had told me that there's two independent games, you could buy them and play them on their own, but you can combine them into a third game, that's an exciting idea. And I am very interested to see if somebody else has executed on this, or what this, if executed to, you know, whatever my standard is, would be interesting. It would look like, and whether it would be fun and interesting. And I want to draw a parallel to a piece of video game design advice that I read a while ago, like a long time ago, I think on Reddit or something. Somebody had mentioned how they had an idea for an MMORPG, and somebody giving them genuine advice was saying, like, your idea for a game, you know, is really big and complicated, has a very wide scope, and so it's very risky, and it's going to take a long time to build it. Their suggestion was, take just a portion of that game and create a mini game of sorts and see if it's fun. And if it's fun, then you're onto something. Then do that with another aspect of the game. See if that aspect of the game is fun. Then in the end, not only have you like done some of the work already and you've already got some practice in, but when you put them together, it's probably still going to be fun. And you could take that advice and apply it to board games when approaching a board game design from the model that Century, Spice Road, Eastern Wonders, A New World has established. That like maybe you have an idea for a super complicated 4X board game, maybe consider breaking that idea down into smaller pieces, seeing if each of those pieces is fun, and then, you know, maybe you could publish them as their own game and then build upon things like that. That could be very exciting. There's probably a lot of things that I'm not considering when suggesting this method of game design and publishing, but I'm interested to see what else there is out there in this vein. And it makes me excited to potentially design something like this.
You know, I'm just thinking about Charterstone, how more than the other legacy games we've played, or at least I've played, every session of Charterstone, or at least Charterstone frequently felt like it was adding mechanics that like radically changed how I viewed the game.
Mm-hmm.
I think that like a legacy game is sort of a good example of a similar idea to this, where it builds off of itself with something different that changes how you view the game, and so when you combine them, it makes it more appealing, I guess. It makes it more drastic. But yeah, I think this is a game that makes me excited to design games more than it makes me excited to play games.
Yeah, that's a good
point. I can agree with that.
That's a good way of putting it. I would want to add to all of this, but also that, like, this is all coming from our perspective of what we enjoy in board gaming. And for certain people, Century Spice Road is the perfect game. Like it has just enough complexity for them to feel like, for someone to feel like they're making cool choices, but it's not, you know, this rules laden complex combination of systems that other board games can be. You know, for somebody, Century Spice Road is the perfect game. So, and I don't hate on that at all. You know, I appreciate that perspective.
Yes.
So, you know, we prefer Eastern Wonders. Somebody else might prefer Spice Road, and that's fine. But yeah, I'm interested personally to see where this concept could go.
Yeah, I will say one last thing about Eastern Wonders.
Okay.
It's a bit busy. It can be hard to parse the symbols. So I can understand if somebody doesn't like it as much, because every market has its own rate to consider, and they're mm-hmm. all visible all the time, and you do nothing but add more tokens to those markets.
I mean, frankly, like, Spice Road can be a little busy too. Like, when we played and we set out those six cards, I was like, why should I care about any one of these cards over the others, you know? It took a couple turns to figure out exactly which kinds of cards I was looking for in that game.
Yeah.
Just because I'm just... Because, again, the game's just about exchanging cubes for other cubes. It's like when you are set out, like, do you want the card that exchanges two green cubes into four yellow cubes and a red cube? Or would you rather have the card that exchanges two yellow cubes into a brown cube? I don't know. You tell me.
You know, this is kind of a... this is kind of a distillation of a lot of board games. This is like the sitcom joke about board games.
Yeah. All right. I think maybe at that we should stop talking about cubes and cards and say that is the end of our episode discussing Century Spice Road and Century Eastern Wonders. Thank you for listening.